This is the NedGroup Investments podcast, where we explore a variety of views and insights that investors care about.
Hello, I'm Robin Johnson, Head of Investments at NedGroup Investments, and I'm joined today by Ian Beattie, CIO and co-founder of NS Partners, portfolio managers on our NedGroup Investments Global Emerging Markets Fund. Hello, Ian. Thanks for joining us today.
It's a pleasure, Rob.
So we're going to kick off with a question about emerging markets and the emerging market development ladder. Would you mind just explaining what that means?
Yeah, I think some people talk about development in emerging markets as though it's a random or chance and it's very difficult to forecast. But actually, there's a lot of academic work on this. And traditionally, we put them in five stages. Many people now add a sixth stage. So you can see that countries need certain conditions in place and need to put in certain policies in order to get from one stage to a higher one. In other words, they go from poor to takeoff, and then they get wealthier and so on as they become what we rather patronisingly call developed markets at some point.
And that transition from emerging markets to developed markets, what's that final stage? And are there any countries that you look at that are making that jump or likely to?
Well, that's where it gets really interesting, because many people identify the middle income trap. So there's an assumption, I think, in the past that countries would naturally go from poor to middle to wealthy. But actually, some of them get stuck. They can get stuck at any stage. But the ones that really capture the attention are the ones that get stuck in middle income just when it looks like there's a really great investment story or a really great story for the people of that country. They suddenly slow down and they become a cyclical investment rather than a quality compounder, rather than something that's going to grow and grow and grow. And you can see that in certain countries. Argentina was richer than Germany at the beginning of the 20th century, so they obviously got stuck. Singapore has been a fantastic story of development, going from one of the poorest countries in Asia just after the World War II to now one of the richest countries on earth, whereas Malaysia, Kuala Lumpur, has gone from around the same level of development and income per head to getting stuck in this middle income area and a bit much slower growth.
What tend to be the things that get them stuck? What keeps them in that middle income area?
Well, according to some research by INSEAD, and we're also sponsoring another London university to do some more on work on this, it seems to be quality of institutions. It was discovered that you really do need high quality institutions if you're going to get to the sixth stage, if you're going to get to a much wealthier level. And that's what all the countries that have done that have in common. And no country that has high quality institutions has stayed particularly poor. So that does seem to be the common thread. So that then leads us to talk about China in particular, which is at roughly this level now. So China's development up until now, it hasn't needed high-quality institutions. But to get beyond this level, to get wealthier from here, to avoid the middle-income trap, which Mr. Xi is desperate to avoid, the academic evidence seems to suggest that you need high-quality institutions.
When you use the term institutions, what are you referring to there?
The real key cornerstones of society, of a governance structure, in other words. So I think what we see is once the wealth has been generated and businesses do well, entrepreneurs, it's perfectly natural for them to diversify their wealth overseas and for their families and their children to go overseas for education or even to get some work. That's all good and healthy. Everybody's gaining. Everybody's learning more. They're expanding their horizons. They're increasing their knowledge and their skill set and getting diversification of their wealth, buying US treasuries, maybe buying a flat if you're wealthy in Paris or something like that. That's all healthy. But we all know, because we've seen it, that there's sometimes some countries, there's a tipping point, and it isn't just healthy diversification or healthy gaining in experience. It's every member of the family is fleeing and working permanently overseas and never returning. Every last cent is ripped out of that domestic business and it's capital flight. It's leaving permanently, not just diversifying. And then there's not enough money to be reinvested and there's not enough talent to be reinvested in that country. So it's a really important dynamic that separates a country from being a compounder versus being cyclical at that point.
And the institutions you're talking about, the legal system, the banking system, the corporate ability to borrow, to grow.
That's right, Rob. It's law. It's usually separating the legal processes from other methods of government. Mm-hmm. There's some kind of pluralism usually that's important. Now, there's little evidence, I think, to suggest it has to be Western liberal democracy as a model, although that one seems to work. But you do need the idea that people feel safe and they feel listened to. And this probably becomes even more important as governments get bigger and they tax their people. People want a say in how that tax money is spent. So these all become more and more important as you get wealthier.
And if we take a look at India, how are they getting on in terms of their progress through the development ladder?
India has many advantages as well as a few well-known disadvantages. But what you've got to bear in mind when we look at India is it is much poorer. It is much lower on the GDP per head scale than, say, China. So it hasn't got near the middle-income trap yet. But it has many advantages as well as some disadvantages on the infrastructure side, which it's improving on. It does have quite high quality institutions, albeit there is problems as well on corruption and so on. But again, they're improving. So its score is reasonable for its level of wealth, but it's improving. And it has things like democracy and some and legal system and so on, which as it gets wealthier will probably be an advantage.
So when you're looking to allocate capital, you're looking for those countries that are moving forward, right? And then they attract capital into those countries and therefore the people, the wealth in there grows. Is that right?
That's right. You get into a virtuous circle. Right. So the Indian diaspora, they're willing to travel back to India. They're willing to invest back into India, which is a huge positive. And you see that in the numbers. You also have some fantastic reforms that the country has undergone over the last 5 to 10 years or so that has improved the tax take, that has improved the standard of living for ordinary people, whether it's in sanitation, electricity rollout. The tax take improvement is really cannot be underestimated. Welfare is getting, you know, less wasteful and getting to the right people. You've seen some fantastic reforms. There's been tax reform so that companies are more efficient about where they spend their investment and they can trade more within India. All of these things are looking like a virtuous circle to me. And you're starting to get a faster level of growth. India is one of the faster growing economies at the moment, and you can see why that is.
And is transport one of the institutions or the transport network, maybe I should say?
Yeah, so the rail network's been a big problem. All the infrastructure in India is nowhere near to the same standard as China, which is obviously famous for its infrastructure. But that's an area that is being improved. It needs to improve if India is going to take advantage of the China Plus One policy and get its share of foreign direct investment, which it has not been getting until recently. So as we see, the problem with the Indian rail network is it for a manufacturer is it's for the people and people get priority.
Okay.
So going forward, they've built a freight network on the railways just for freight, not for the people. And so that means that manufacturers know with much greater certainty when they're going to get their goods on the input side and when their goods on the output side are going to get delivered, for instance, at the ports. And that changes everything. They can then take their place in the global supply chain. So the C-suite in the US are all talking about China plus one in terms of supply chain.
Okay.
This gives an opportunity to a number of countries, Indonesia, Vietnam. They look very well placed. Mexico also a traditional supply chain actor as well, but it is much higher cost. But it is in NAFTA, so there are some advantages there. So a number of countries stand to benefit from China plus one. But India, I think, is probably going to be one of the surprises in this area, partly because the government is going to really help this take place, but also with these infrastructure improvements, admittedly from a very low base.
I'm going to ask a question that I think I ask every time is, I know you cover both emerging markets and developed markets. Where's the smart money now? Is it time to allocate some of your wealth to emerging markets?
Yeah, we're getting really close to banging the table on that, but not yet, I think.
Okay.
That could change in a quarter or so. So we're lining up, we're getting ready, but we still need a few indicators to turn. Basically, we probably need to see conditions in the West improve. So although the emerging markets look good, we're still a bit cautious on the developed markets, and emerging markets don't normally decouple. So despite the fact that one's looking better than the other, we want to see developed markets look okay, and then we can get more bullish on emerging markets. They don't like going in a different direction to developed markets.
We're
not quite brave enough to say, yeah, they look better and they're going to do better. We want to see them both looking okay, and then we'll expect emerging markets to do better even more.
Right, so they look better in terms of valuation, a better place to...
Valuation, earnings set to be better. Money supply growth is much stronger in emerging than developed, although still not super strong. Inflation is obviously better. Purchasing parity, so the real effective exchange rate of many emerging markets is very, very competitive. So when people worry about globalization, it's really difficult at this level of the dollar that we got to, that to see that actually happening. You still need the supply chain to be based outside the dollar for any firm to be competitive. So I really don't see that reversing. And some of these countries are extreme levels. Northeast Asian ones, or East Asian ones in particular, look very, very competitive on an exchange rate basis. So I think they're still going to be around. I think globalization still looks well set. So valuations look good. Earnings look okay. Money supply is improving, whereas it's deteriorating in the West. Commodities, maybe they need a bit of a setback before we get bullish on those. But yeah, the scene is set for emerging markets to do well. I just think we can get the timing a little bit better.
And last question from me today. Do we need to see a risk-on environment in the developed markets for EM to really take off?
I would say we definitely want to...
People are cautious, right,
yeah,
still.
I would definitely want to see the absence of a risk-off.
Okay.
So I'm kind of saying yes. And that's why we're not quite banging the table on it yet. We're too cautious on developed markets to say, yeah, we can buy EM here. So we need to see that settled. It doesn't need to be risk-on, but we don't want to be going in the opposite direction before you can buy EM.
Okay, great. Well, thank you so much for your time. Keep coming up with the great ideas in the Emerging Markets Equity Fund, and thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me. Thanks, Rob.
Ned Group Collective Investments is an authorised collective investments scheme manager in terms of the Collective Investments Schemes Control Act. Ned Group Investments does not provide advice on financial products and will only give you factual information. For further details on our funds and to view our terms and conditions, please visit netgroupinvestments.co.za. Ned Group Investments, see money differently.